You have all that memorized, I'm sure. You have the same handouts as you've had for the last 2 or 3 weeks. Romans 1:21, Hebrews 11:3, Romans 1:22. Romans 1:21, because having known God, not as God, did they give him worship or glory, and not as God, did they give him thanks. Not as God did they give him any recognition. And then something happened to him. And this is review to you that have been here. Because, in God's view, you see, if he is... Just imagine for a moment what most of the time you take for granted, but you don't really think about the fact that you take it for granted. You just do it. You don't really want to think about it, because to think about it is to reveal how stupid we are. Nobody likes to face that. Nobody likes to get up in the morning when we look our worst. Say, hello, ugly, hello, stupid. And we sure don't want a companion to come in behind us and look in the same mirror and say to us, so we don't think about this. So I'm going to force you to imagine it for a moment. You're God. Now, you take it for granted, and it governs most of your actions, because God is sovereign. It's part of our God-likeness we know isn't true, but we hope that we can be closer to being true than other people, namely eternal. Most of us want to be like God and never die. Our first knee-jerk reaction on any subject that comes up is we're omniscient. Know it all. And we are sometimes disturbed that other people cannot recognize those qualities about us. They're so obvious. Well, God is all of those things. And all this clawing around and challenging him and coming up with ideas like God has to learn as he goes along how to be right. And eventually he learns how to be right or righteous according to our standard. No, if God is, he is. Why he settled the question with Moses, who shall I tell the greatest ruler in the world has sent me? I am that I am. That settles it. I can be what I want to be, do what I want to do, and I can decide what about you I like and don't like, and I can decide with no appeals court to do you in with a blink of the eye. And I really, if you are listening in my book of Revelation, I once came close to doing it with the people. I said, get out of the way, Moses. I'm just wiping them all out. Now, I don't really think God had to be reminded by Moses. of what he had said. I think he was close to doing what he did to Eli. To Eli, he said, don't remind me of what I promised about you and the loins of Aaron, of a perpetual priesthood. I know what I said, so don't bother to remind me. But this is what I'm saying now. I'm wiping you and your line out. He knocked the old man off the log and broke his neck. I'm sure he knew what he had said to Israel. Moses just prevailed upon him. But arguing the consequences to a larger audience of the world and eternity, really. Now, there was nobody there to plead Eli's case. Not how it had worked anyway. The point is, God can do whatever he wants to do. Now, I'm going to say one thing that I'll demonstrate later. Hundreds of millions of miles across this universe. Hundreds of millions of miles. And I will show you as the message goes on what the consequences would be with the slightest deviation. This universe, this sun, as grand as it is, and the planets that go around it, if hypothetically you could imagine that in a vast arena of space, and even imagine there is a God who just created this universe, and sits somewhere back in another universe and looks on, isn't it pretty? He speaks it into existence in a moment. It would cease to be if this is all there is. The balance of the entire universes, whatever name you would have put on them, the galaxies, the supernovas, the stars, the so-called dark matter that's speculated if it's there, or the space, the movements, the whole of it is necessary. With critically, extremely minute deviations. The whole of it is necessary. The light that is reaching us from a star 600 million years ago. What we're seeing is the light from the star as it was 600 million years ago. This universe could not be without the whole balanced conglomerate. Now, Carl Sagan said, the cosmos is all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be. We're challenging that. But the cosmos that he says is and was and is all that will ever be, in its entirety, is necessary for you to be alive on this planet today. The whole thing had to be built to provide this little chamber of life. Well, you say, I don't believe that. Well, I'll show you in a few minutes. And only one part, this is saying the thrust of my message, and then I'll go on with it. Only one part, as I said at the close of last Sunday's message, only one part of this conglomerate called the cosmos stars. Are absolutely necessary for the rest of it. The paradox is we find the stars are made of atoms. And we find that only in the heat at the heart of stars, or if there was a Big Bang, the energy released in that first second that no one can peer back to, even though they postulate the Big Bang. Only in heat of that level can the process start from which all the building blocks of reality have come forth, atoms. That's why the song that some of you will remember used to proclaim, "We are stardust, made of the ashes of exploding and burning stars, so delicately measured that without stars there would be none of the atoms of which everything here is made." I gave the credit to Leon last Sunday. Wrong scientist, Lee Smolin. He lays out the statistical probability on page 45 of The Life of the Cosmos. He lays out the statistical probability, taking all the parameters of the basic building blocks of reality as they now call the standard model that the majority of physicists agree upon are the basic units from which elements build up to atoms as we know it, and all the rest of the universe that grows out of that, the chances of starting from nothing or any perimeter in existence having the absence of stars, 1 in 10 to the 229th. Or 1 with 229 zeros. So take a 1, and I hope somebody did it since last time, and see how many pieces of paper it takes to fill a 1 followed by 229 zeros. That's the probability of stars forming by chance. That's the risk factor. That stars, if formed by chance, came out, 1 out of alternate options with no stars, 1 to 1 with 229 zeros behind it. That boggles the mind. In other words, it's impossible for stars to form by chance. And for stars, then, to produce the elements of atoms, and atoms to produce current mankind. The probability figures sail out of orbit. And you come to that final thing that the Bible says in one sentence. Having said, "Let us make man in our image," and he didn't say man or mankind, he issues that word, he said Adam, from which we get Adam. "Let us make Adam in our image." Formed something out of the dust of the earth. He did form Adam out of atoms. But he did something else. He breathed into him. He breathed into him. Adam became a living soul. You can spend the rest of your life reading all the books ever written on it. This is probably the latest, The Mysterious Flame by Colin McGinn. It's this book from which Houston Smith gets the reference to that science fiction novel about invaders from space that I read to you the other day, but I think I'm going to repeat it again. They've coined a word like the Mysteriums. Nobody can explain how you get from brain to mind to consciousness and all that makes man different than anything else. And you know, the book of Ephesians says that God has chosen to bless his people by spoken word. And faith, Hebrews 11:3, the passage you have there, says faith begins on this starting point. We believe that the things that are seen were made from the things not seen, nothing. And Hebrews chapter 1 makes it clear who that word of God that Hebrews 11 is talking about formed the things that are seen from nothing by the word of God, the word eternal who became the incarnate word and the preached word and the teached word from which we get the written word, fulfills the promise of God's name where he says in a word that we get eulogy from, eulogia, that his means of blessing mankind is by word. Now, Joe Mann, who discovered the quark and gave it its name, the quark, the smallest building blocks, way beneath the atom, six of them, strange names, up, down, strange, charm, up, down, strange, charm, top, bottom. They haven't found the top one yet, the heaviest one of the quarks. He gave it its name. Vitally involved in the Santa Fe Institute, an acronym you often see in science writings, SFI. It said of him, by another physicist, Joe Mann has five brains, and each of them smarter than anybody else's brain. He discovered and named the quarks. And Joe Mann gives a list in this book, The Quark and the Jaguar, that I'll come back to in a few minutes. I don't want to do it yet. In which he seeks to bring together all the various learning disciplines in one place where it's a think tank, where they study everything from butterflies coming out of cocoons to profound theoretical physics to the way a child learns a language. And the reference point right now is that the research into the way children learn languages and the connection to SFI and Santa Fe is that they're impressed with the sort of selective grouping. It started, he says, when he was a boy and he'd walk through the parks in New York and see different kinds of sparrows, but they never saw crossbreed sparrows. And seldom do species crossbreed in their ability to perpetuate their genes. And when they do, the product is usually sterile, unable to continue production of the crossbreed. And he passed this on to the study of language groups. I mean, the tragedy of so many of these scientists is, I love their genius and their curiosity. I mean, my own love of language and the way that words flow out of the Indo-European base, and the same words crop up again and again with slight modification in the tree of meanings attached to words. And they have concluded that, unlike animals, when you plot statistically the way a child learns grammar, he isn't given a grammar book. We all wish we could learn, and all children have the ability to learn two and three languages more easily than we can learn one when we're an adult. And that early phase of exposure he's talking about, his own little child, how the first words delighted him. He's going out, and the little kid says, "Daddy, go, go, car!" Now, how did this child know, in contrast with other languages, that the subject comes first and the verb in the middle and the object at the end? I mean, he didn't have the grammar right. "Daddy is going to go away in the car." But the kid had it. "Daddy, go, go, car." And it's this kind of stuff that is woven into the tree of SFI to anticipate something, so I won't have to go to the book and prove it. In the mixture of disciplines and subject matter that they are seeking to mix cross field of various disciplines of knowledge, there's not a single voice there with the religious perspective. And of all the subjects named, religion's left out, which is the point of where I'm going, the tunnel that we've been talking about, borrowing from Houston Smith, who borrowed from someone else. Scientism. Science achievements has so awed the world. And as Stephen Hawking says, the world is so far behind because even the specialists in science haven't caught up yet. You can read all you want about Stephen Hawking. I got three books over here in recent years. His most popular, A Brief History of Time. Then he follows that with an update and some additions on the end about wormholes that he'd done after he did black holes and baby universes. And you think that the last position, that Stephen Hawking, who's the most widely known and popular because of his bestseller, Physicist, even though he's never won a Nobel Prize, but he occupies the honorary chair that gives him stature, maybe above all physicists, because Newton had it. I have to read the book about nothing to find that Hawking has changed off of his imaginary time universe. And that was the last one that was supposedly, in fact, his declaration was, in the future, thinking in terms of imaginary time, which is treating time like we treat minuses in math. There isn't any such thing as minus two. You can't go to a basket of eggs and find the minus two eggs. Yet minus two times four leaves two. I mean, you take away the minus two, four, you're left with plus two. There ain't any such thing as minus two. I mean, you may insult your companion by calling them that, but it's an imaginary number for convenience in working mathematical equations that can plow through the minuses and come out with a final figure. Imaginary time's the same. And he imagines time like a sphere, so he gets around the Big Bang because he didn't want to face up to what his own formulas prove, that the Big Bang and the black holes lead you to a starting point, a singularity, started somewhere. Somebody banged it out. Now, his imaginary time is sometimes illustrated with a riddle. We've been singing together. Let me give you a riddle. Walk. You, wake up. Walk 1 mile due south. Got that? Walk 1 mile due south. Walk 1 mile due east. Walk 1 mile due north. Where are you and what color are the bears? Smart out, Alex. White. Because they're polar bears. Right? Because only from the North Pole can you walk due south a mile, due west or east a mile, due north a mile, because it triangulates. Comes right back to the North Pole. So the bears have to be white. Well, time is horizontal and moving forward, the arrow of time, and Hawking came up with some way to avoid the Big Bang or the singularity of black holes, because instead of a Big Bang being the starting point, it's the North Pole, and it starts everything expanding, and at the equator, it's maximized, and then it starts to come back down to the South Pole, and start again, and come back. So there's no collapsing. It's like you think you're walking on flat land on the Earth, and there are no boundaries. You just keep going around, around, around. Now, of course, the only place that life could live is this first quarter here. The rest of it doesn't exist. You can go backwards in time. All the theoretical concept that he said would become as common, it would be discussed over kitchen tables by non-physicists in years to come. And I just discovered this week he left it. He left it. God made something different is the biblical attitude. In 1 second, I've said for years, even if evolution were true, though the icons of Darwinism and evolutionary theory are exploded as so many of them fraudulent and lies, and I'd recommend every parent get for their kids Icons of Evolution, Science or Myth by Jonathan Wells. This book shows, as I did in 2 messages back, the fraudulent basis of what is perpetuated as solid experiments. I can only use one in the time I have today, such as the adaptation of certain butterflies to pepper trees with pictures that show them adopting for survival so that their color can match the tree, when in fact those butterflies don't even land on those trees. It's all a lie. Doesn't happen. Never did happen. And thoroughly researched are these frauds in evolutionary theory that are propounded as fact, and Jonathan Wells thoroughly documents that they are continued, declared as facts, when the scientists know that they have been exploded and articles have proven them to be fraud. In other words, science moved so wonderfully fast and has produced so much that is technically bettering our life and our understanding of the world around us, that it took off and became the religion of the 20th century. It became a religion by the addition of the words scientism. And though lawyers and educators and media voices are 10 years behind, some cases 20, 30 years behind, where the leading voices of science are today. They have fixed, culture has caught up, as the taxonomy I put on the board when I was analyzing the church a year or two ago. Culture, unwritten laws of behavior, are among the most powerful controlling forces. You are not acceptable. You are not intelligent. You are somehow a freak if you don't recognize what scientism proclaims. Not science, scientism. That the method of science, experimentation, mathematical projection of theories, tests to see if it can be falsified, that, if not the only source of truth, is the best source of truth and the only reality that exists from which truth can be extracted, is the material world, Sagan's cosmos, all there is, all there ever was, all there ever will be. Now, science doesn't require that view. Scientism has captured the mind, particularly of the Western world, and it becomes the foundation of a tunnel that limits vision. On the left, higher education is a wall based upon the premises of scientism. Law, based upon deifying the premises of scientism, and the media, their current prophets and priests who proclaim it with sneers and eyebrows lifted and general attitude. I'd like you to see a media person giving the respect to a man in religion who just won the Templeton Award that they give to a Nobel Prize winner in science. I would like to see the media some night pull the provost of Fuller Theological Seminary, Russ Fittler, whom I've known for 40 years, and give him the respect they give the head of the Department of Physics at UCLA or some medical institution. It's a state of mind that has deified science as the only or best method of finding truth, ultimate truth. And the material world as the only place where that truth can be extracted. Houston Smith's decrying it, I'm decrying it, but I'm going beyond Houston Smith to say it is the result of what is proclaimed in Romans 1, 21. The wrath of God in the previous verse, the wrath of God, orgy, from heaven is revealed against all mankind that fails to recognize God's reality and give Him thanks. And God is saying in this passage and the ones that preceded it, the creation is His doing, and He's left enough marks of His handiwork that without any other revelation, He expects. Paul is not debating this, he's declaring it. God expects that at the very least, the amazing handiwork of the creation forces a recognition of the craftsman, a supreme being, and should bring the response of recognition of His presence, that He is, and thanksgiving for what He's done. And having that knowledge and not worshiping Him, giving Him value for what He's provided for us as a playland in which we can explore forever its intricacies and marvel and sing the song, How Great Thou Art. Because having known God by that method as an intuitive, basic capacity of all mankind, and haven't recognized Him or thanked Him, the wrath of God, present tense, is poured out to produce a result. And the result that is produced is God's wrath working right now. The failure to humbly be aware of a creed. This is the difference between Paul and current idiots who try to engage in debates with atheists who are already the object of God's wrath. Paul's not arguing. He's simply saying, you have turned yourself into an ass. Biblical ass. But you've not only turned yourself into an ass, God gave you a assiness show. Well, I'm not going to believe it. Make my day, God is saying. I want it understood. There's not any debate going on here. I'm just passing Paul on. There's not any... Engage your brain now and see if I, as the interpreter of Paul, and telling you what Paul said, can convince you. That's not the issue. The risk factor of perversely ruling God out of His creation. And as I said the last two Sundays, I'm more tolerant than God. My exposure in the field, the force field of skepticism, and the force field, it qualifies with that kind of feeling that blacks have when people that are racist think that because of the color of their skin, they just can't rise to the level of those who are judging them. I mean, an ignorant skinhead that the only possible education that a skinhead should have is to be put in the ring with Ali at his best. Or turn Clint Eastwood movies into reality and have Clint Eastwood and his big gun hunting them down. They are among the world's greatest candidates for the missing link. Oh, I'll get mail from this, and I'll increase my security and hope that Clint Eastwood will apply. But the feeling, you can't rise above it. You could win a Nobel Prize and somebody would say you dyed your skin because you couldn't have been black and got it. This is a rainbow congregation. You blacks know what I'm talking about?
Yes, sir.
You Afro-Americans, the names change all the time. You ever run into that? It's an unseen force field. You just are an inferior person because your skin's that color. And you know, I remember the shock on some of my audience face when I was doing deep studies in archaeology and ancient anthropology, when the evidence is that Adam and Eve were dark. And the mark on Cain, if it was a color, was white. There's more evidence to that than the other way around. That may bother the hell out of you, but... And you know, the quest for superiority made me hark back to the days when they used to ask me if I had, in those days they used the word Negro, if I had Negro blood in me because my hair was tightly curly. I'm proud of that. Because I really only recognize one face, and that's the one race, and that's the race of Jesus Christ, born again, new creatures in Christ Jesus, and one color, and that's the red blood of Jesus Christ that redeems, and the blood that flows in all of us. But the point I'm making is, I hope that person's leaving because of a kidney ailment or sickness and not because of their color. Not a racist bone in my body. Have difficulty conceptually even understanding it. But I sure understand what it's like to be a victim of a state of mind that gives you zero chance. At a certain event horizon, you're not allowed to rise above it. And in the academic world, and I'm not yet to this wall, which is the left wall built on this foundation of scientism, the left wall, there's a horizon you're not allowed to rise above. Not allowed to rise above. And that is a believer in miracles and religion. You're well aware that newspapers, for example, a writer can write a very favorable story, but the editors will try to find a catchy headline. And the headline is like some evangelist in my boyhood's sermon titles. You'd go because of the sermon title, and nothing in the sermon was even close to the title. Headlines do that. I still remember when I was sought after by the Stanford Alumni magazine to be their cover story. And it happened to come out between Margaret Thatcher and Gorbachev. I'm the only preacher in the history of that grand institution that was founded on Christian faith, by the way. But I'm the only preacher. PhD in philosophies of education, I probably broke the crockery and the bricks in several directions just with vibrations when I was allowed to do my doctoral dissertation on the theology of Reinhold Niebuhr, and was allowed as one of my two doctoral languages, along with French, to have New Testament or classical or Koine Greek. And now, be on the cover of the Stanford Alumni magazine as a preacher, between world figures and Stanford alumni worldwide, you're going to see, we produced a preacher who obviously believes in miracles and the resurrection of Christ. Now, the primary source for the article was, I think of his name now. Who? No. That's a guy I did my doctorate on. The writer, Alan Parentini. You saw him recently as a spokesperson on TV for the ACLU. And he's continued to be prominent in vital, cutting-edge affairs. He was the son, I think, of an Episcopalian minister. 15, 20 years ago, somewhere around there, he was picked by the Times LA Times to do a 2-year investigative report on me. And by his own testimony, and calling, he'll tell you that. He said he started with a blank piece of paper, figurative of his mind. And he made up his mind, if he found anything bad, he was going to write it. And if he didn't, he was going to say so, that he didn't. It was Alan Parrucchini who went to the Attorney General's office at that time, when they were trying in every way possible to shift my fight of constitutional matters and argue to the man instead of the fact, and in essence confronted him. Why are you allowing to and helping to circulate a story that Dr. Scott, who I had a twin brother and sister, not my twins, but twin brothers and sisters, were born to my mother and father, my brother and sister, in the midst of Dad's sickness. And the little girl died shortly after just the moment of birth, and the little boy lived a very short time. And Alan Parrucchini went in and said, why are you allowing and being silent about and supporting the story that Dr. Scott, in a fit of anger, choked or smothered his little brother with a pillow because he was irritated at his crying, when a simple trip to Oroville could have disproved it in a moment? For 2 years, he followed me around. For 2 years, he probed into every nook and cranny. And he wrote an 8-page article in the calendar section then of the LA Times, The Life and Times of an Electronic Pastor. And until he left the Times, I wouldn't let anybody interview me but him, because he had proven his honesty. He didn't write a puff article. He told the truth. And when it came time for the Stanford article to be written, he wrote it. Originally, before he left the Times, he was supposed to be the one that was writing the article for the LA Magazine that they later brought a man out from Washington, D.C., whom I angered a little because I wouldn't give him an interview. And from his research, Alan Parrucchini did the basis of the article for the Stanford Alumni Magazine. Now, what's this got to do with what I'm saying? The article was very factual, very accurate, no puff article, just the way it is. What you see is what you get. But the editors picked one of my non-sweetheart pictures off of television, because everybody knows. Do I get mad at my congregation? I sure do. But you know it right away. And it's over with. But, you know, I can lean into the camera and bellow. And fire goes out of my eyes. They had one of those pictures. They blew it up for the cover. And the editors put, Dr. James Scott, demigod, demigod, or demagogue, in bold type. Had nothing to do with the article. But at the editorial level, they had to do something to reduce down, to let the world know that at least somebody there with the pen that could write the headline didn't want the world to think that Stanford was embracing a preacher who believed in such mentally deficient ideas as the resurrection of Christ and miracles. Well, if I could give that editor the finger on TV, where did that go? That painting. I would say, sorry, sir. I got the PhD from Stanford that probably you don't have. Because I don't know any editors of the magazine that have PhDs. I already passed muster, but I know the problems of scientism that belittle any belief outside this tunnel, a transcendent God. It's as C.S. Lewis says, the issue of miracles in his little booklet, Miracles. The issue of miracles is very simple. If the cosmos is all there is, and if the scientific method of cause and effect, and he was there before they uncovered quarks and Higgs boson and other things, if there is anything that can be found in this universe that opens a door to the unpredictable, the uncertain, at that sub-level, a back door of something that can change the fundamental nature of material that goes by fixed laws of cause and effect in time and space and etc., then there's logically the possibility of a front door. But all scientism wants to rule God out. Now, I'm going to take 70 league boots with you and move fast now. Scientism doesn't want to accept the reality of God. And I've said it 5 times now. The real reason is psychological, not factual. Because they don't want to accept a sovereign, a master, one over them. Now, suck in your breath and follow me now. They don't want a boss. That's what Lucifer didn't want. He said, I'll ascend and be like God. That's what he got Adam and Eve to fall for. Eat of that tree and you'll be like God. This that I started with an hour ago, this that I started with, that we really don't want to face it, but we all want to be God. We don't want a sovereign. And the fact that he's immutable, he's not going to change, he ain't going to outlast him. You don't want to bow before him. And God says, that very attitude from the footprints in creation that he has left is a test pattern. A test pattern. He left enough marks from his view. He left enough marks that at the very least you should recognize he is. Stand in awe before his product and thankful for what he's provided you. Failure to do that releases his wrath right now. And the way his wrath works, he withdraws a capacity that was there. Have you ever noticed how you break the word insight down? Now, there must be sight to see light. And insight is that capacity in you to see God's presence from his handiwork. It's there, however faint, as going back to gel man, there is something in little children of mankind as distinct from little ones of baboons. That is a capacity for words, a capacity innate to sort out words. And as a child, matriculate your way through endless statistical options. And the ability of a child to learn language By just hearing words and forming words and developing a language. They have now concluded is an innate quality that makes man fundamentally different, which goes back to God decreeing that he would work with this creation and bless this creation through words, and thus he gives to us in that element he put into Adam, word capacity. He also gives to man insight, capacity to at least include in the options, more tolerant on my part than God, who doesn't want to be just one of the options. He unbiddingly says through Paul, you don't recognize me, worship me and thank me. This is what I'm going to do to you. I'm going to take from you the capacity to find me at all. I'm going to take from you the capacity to see right. I'm going to push you away from me and leave you with an absence of light, which is the fundamental definition of darkness, until you will become like those who love darkness more than light, because their deeds are evil. And he describes this in the Greek as self-deceiving, as translated became vain. In their reasoning or dialogues, talk, 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 but self-deceiving in their talk, because it's flowing out of a darkened, senseless heart. Insight having been removed, and go to that other page, Hebrews 11:3, to the 22nd verse, professing to be wise, sophoi, from which we get sophomore, sophisticated, sophistry, professing to be wise, they become foolish, it says in the translation. The word in the Greek, emoranthison, moron. Professing to be wise, they become empty heads. They become morons. They become incapable of finding the truth. That's what I've checked these books up. It amazes me that such geniuses, demonstrate the proof of what Paul's saying here. And you can find the reasons. Now, the reasons are very simple. They want not to have a God. They don't want to be mastered. Anywhere, anytime. They just don't want to be mastered. Let me look at Stephen Hawking here. I warn you. Take a deep breath. I read this to you. As a young boy, I was in the despair out of Stephen Hawking's universe, because I'd always taken things apart to see what made them tick, tick. Of course, I generally couldn't get them back together again, but I felt that if I understood how something worked, then in a sense, I was the master of it. That's the motive. They want to be the master. You can find on the internet some interesting stuff under the God particle. But there is an article I pulled out, a critical article, very important article, because it tells you things about Stephen Hawking that most people won't know. I read from the end of science about his divorce from his wife, Jean, who could no longer tolerate his atheism. But here's an article off the internet, Stephen Hawking's The Big Bang and God, by Dr. Henry Fritz Schaefer, Graham Purdue Professor of Chemistry and the Director of the Center for Computational Quantum Chemistry for the University of Georgia, nominated for a Nobel Prize. He has an interesting story about Stephen Hawking. And he says, Hawking is probably the most famous living scientist. He even recommends that he be read. He has great respect for him. But he says, a brief history of time says a lot about God. God is mentioned in this book from beginning to end. So let's try to put Hawking's opinions about God in some sort of context. And I'm putting it in the context of someone who confronts the capacity for knowledge and the capacity to show at least recognition of God's existence, and failure to do so has God take from them the capacity to be reached, the capacity to find God, the capacity to recognize God. In other words, they are in a category of sense removal. God's sense removal. And the wrath of God is against all Asabian lack of God consciousness. God removes the capacity. The wrath of God is not just out there. It is very present. I could go to Hebrews 3 and preach this without any science, with the illustration of the Old Testament saints who had a pernicious, one of the names of Satan himself, a pernicious heart of disbelief. A pernicious heart of disbelief. The prince of the power of the air pervades this world, if the Bible's correct. That same pervasive influence that made Adam and Eve doubt is what makes doubt so much easier than faith. Yet even on a scientific criteria, it's as ignorant to disbelieve without evidence as it is to believe without evidence. But everybody starts disbelieving. I could preach God's hatred of what he calls a pernicious heart of disbelief that caused him to hit him with his wrath. Again, this context is, I have great admiration for one of the greatest minds of this century that has conquered impossible odds, suffering Lou Gehrig's disease, as we call it here in America, in a wheelchair, unable to talk, using a computer to give his lectures, and his sense of humor that stays. The context is that Stephen Hawking made up his mind about God long before he became a cosmologist. The principal influence in his early life was his mother, Isabel. Isabel Hawking was a member of the Communist Party in England in the 1930s, and her son has carried a good bit of that intellectual baggage right through his life. By the time he was 13, Hawking's hero was the atheistic philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell. At the same age, two of Hawking's friends became Christians as a result of the 1955 Billy Graham London campaign. According to his 1992 biographers, Hawking stood apart from these encounters with a certain amused detachment. There's nothing in a brief history of time that deviates in a significant way from the religious views of 13-year-old Stephen Hawking. The most important event of his life occurred on December 31st, 1962. Am I boring you? He met his future wife, Jane Wilde, at a New Year's Eve party. 1 month later, he was diagnosed with a terrible disease, ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease in our language. He was given 2 years to live at that time. That was 32 years ago. I've had three friends die of this disease. It's a horrible disease. They lasted 2, 3, and 5 years respectively. But by anyone's estimation, Stephen Hawking is a medical miracle. At this point in his life, Stephen was, by all accounts, an average performing graduate student at Cambridge University. Let me quote from his biographers, White and Griffin, on this point. There's little doubt that Jane Wilde's appearance on the scene was a major turning point in Stephen Hawking's life. The two of them began to see a lot more of one another, and a strong relationship developed. It was finding Jane that enabled him to break out of his depression and regenerate some belief in his life and work. For Hawking, his engagement to Jane was probably the most important thing that ever happened to him. It changed his life, gave him something to live for, and made him determined to live. They married in July of 65. Hawking himself has said, "What really made a difference was that I got engaged to a woman named Jane Wilde that gave me something to live for." Jane Hawking's an interesting person in her own right. She has a doctorate in medieval Portuguese literature. But Jane Hawking is a Christian. She made the statement in 1986, without my faith in God, well, I wouldn't have been able to live in this situation, namely the deteriorating health of her husband. I would not have been able to marry Stephen in the first place because I wouldn't have had the optimism to carry me through. And I wouldn't have been able to carry on with it. And the second of this two-part article, he comes to another statement about Jane Hawkins, or rather about Stephen. One of the persons closest to Stephen, I'm trying to get you to see, God gives people their chances. One of the persons closest to Stephen Hawking, whom you'd know if you'd seen the movie about A Brief History of Time, is Donald Page. Page has had an excellent physics career in his own right, but he started to become famous as a postdoctoral fellow with Stephen Hawking. The Hawkings were not financially well off in the years prior to his book and needed some help to keep going, so the postdoctoral fellows would come to live with Hawkings. Donald Page did this for 3 years. Page described these years in his book, the book about the film and about the book. He said, I would usually get up around 7:15 or 7:30, take a shower, read my Bible and pray. Then I'd go down and get Stephen up. After breakfast, I'd often tell him what I'd been reading in the Bible, hoping that this would eventually have some influence. I remember telling Stephen one story about how Jesus had seen the deranged man and how this man had these demons and the demons had been sent into a herd of swine. The swine then plunged over the edge of the cliff and into the sea. This will say it all if you're subtle in your reasoning. Stephen piped up and said, well, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals would not like that story, would they? Funny. Without a capacity to give respect to God. Oh, there is nothing that is more demeaning than humor to put things down. Nothing. And that's what pervades the writings of the scientists that are captured by scientism. God is the brunt of a joke. He's not to be taken seriously, but he's a nice part of a solo comedy routine. The put down. He doesn't exist, so in the tunnel we joke about him, the non-existent one. I want you to understand that this is a condition where insight, that these are not men without opportunity. God mad at the heathen who has nothing but the universe. Here are those that have studied the universe and all of its mysteries, reduced it down to all reality, all matter. All matter, six quarks. The up, downs, I said. Strange and charm and top and bottom. Leptons. Electrons and electron neutrinos. Muons and muon neutrinos. Tau and tauon neutrinos. I mean, the average person, certainly the media people, and the judges and the higher education people don't even know those basic elements of the standard model from which the perimeters, these are the building blocks of the universe, that all the perimeters are then. Then there's forces. Gravity, electromagnetism, and the weak force, and the strong force. And these balance the activities throughout. And then these forces work through messenger particles, photons, and the weak force through W minus and W plus and Z balance, no charge of any kind. And then gluons, messengers that produce glue balls, eight of them. And then now they've come up with Higgs field, which is some plasma that's boiling down there that has its own messenger particles of Higgs bosons, and jumping in and out of this, from nothing come things. And the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty says you can't pin them down. You measure where they are, you change them, you can't measure velocity, speed, and position at the same time. And then this produces a whole field of philosophy that's the basis of the educational side of experimentalism that does away with fixed entities of any kind, and everything is a wave and a sea of reality, to where Heisenberg, who would not break from Nazi Germany, by the way, and those that reasoned from the uncertainty principle, that really what we're examining, this so-called source of all truth, the material world, is appearance and not reality. Because as we examine it, it becomes. And we're back to the freshman question, does the sound in the woods occur unless somebody's there to hear it? And produces that which is, I'll get on this in the next message, that produces the basis of experimentalism, which is the basis of progressive education, that whole left wall that has filled our kids and produced this generation with no fixed morals, no fixed values of any kind, no fixed truths of any kind. Now, all this, you get the idea in scientism, well, there's a very simple material world that we're exploring, and all the rules are fixed and nothing changes. And the Big Bang is the way it all happened. Well, here's Eric J. Lerner. The Big Bang never happened. And Gil Mann writes a whole book on quarks being like a jaguar in the jungle. Now, I have a little trouble trying to visualize quarks down here in some hot plasma of movement, or any kind of temperature plasma, that become the initial building blocks. I have a hard time seeing a quark as a jaguar. I mean, if they're right, you're sitting on quarks. This cathedral's made out of quarks. You're made out of quarks. I'm quarking at you. But there'd be a lot more attention if there's a jaguar here about to jump. I mean, you know, becoming wise, they become morons. But nothing's worse when they cavalierly. I mean, I got a bunch of books I'm never going to get to, so I'm going to quit trying. Mass, you think you know what mass is? No. They still don't know what mass is. It gives weight. They think that the Higgs field and the Higgs boson, they've spent multiplied billions of dollars to find behind the quarks and behind the electrons, behind the neutrinos, some plasma-like substance that's like molasses that all reality swims in. And the molasses changes as the reality swims through it and gives it, it slows it down, lets it go faster. I mean, the neutrinos and the photons just go through it like it ain't there. But things that have mass get slowed down by the molasses. And they think if they can find that, they're finally down to nothing. Nothing. The whole in the universe. A whole book about nothing. Nothing ain't what it used to be. Nothing, something. Without nothing, you can't have something. Who did it? Nobody. Nobody usually does. Nothing. They're not some fix. They're all a bunch of theorists thinking they're wise. We got another guy here. The end of science. End of science. Where in the hell is he? Well, he ain't there yet. He's not there yet. You missed that. The end of science. After he puts down every theory, he ends up telling about a nightmare he had. That's the basis of his whole philosophy. A nightmare about coming to an end. He woke up and thought he had died. And he then decides that the universe is God winding up and biting his nails, which he calls the terror of God. I'm going to come to an end. Professing to be wise, become fools. The Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Einstein. I guess the rest of these never read that. The Wizard. The Wizard of Quarks. And to avoid a beginning, they come up with what they call bouncing universes. They get almost to the black hole where things would just dissolve and they bounce like a basketball. And then 15 other scientists get in an argument with them and say, no, it's going to hit like a daub of soft mud rather than a basketball on a hardwood floor. They can't decide whether the universe is flat, like a horn, or folded in on itself. And if the other end of it gets close enough to us, a wormhole might let us go into another time zone. And all of this is based upon things we cannot see. You understand what I'm saying? Paul says we look not on the things which are seen, but on the things which are unseen. And I'm a nut. I'm somehow undeserving of the PhD I earned in philosophies of education at Stanford because I believe in the resurrection of Christ. Ignoring the facts, all the time I was there, I tried to find one student, one professor, that could tell me he had read even 15 hours the evidence of the resurrection. No, I didn't think it was worth looking at because it couldn't happen. One of them I respect, he went to the president of New York University. We did our doctorate together. As the girl that was here last Sunday, by the way, I found after the harpist was here that she had the highest academic scholarship from Ball State University of any person that had ever been granted one for academics, not just the harp. And then I remembered that someone I did my doctorate with, we worked with each other, went from Stanford to be president of Ball State. Interesting connections. But the one who went to New York University, I would help him with some of his classes. He'd help me with some of mine. He said to me once, Gene, I agree with you. I shouldn't be speaking as though I have looked at the evidence for the resurrection, because I haven't. You're right. In other words, I'm busted. But I'm not going to spend the 15 hours, as you say, that's minimum. I'm not going to spend those hours. Because if it were true, it would force me to change my whole philosophy on which I built my whole life and intend to build my career, and I'm not willing to take that risk. I respected him. That's an honest but foolhardy decision. But humor from those who know better. If this takes me over the hour, please don't walk out. I'm not going that far. And if there's a shortwave station, I'll be done in time for you to wait a few minutes within the margins of the FCC to interrupt my message. This is the God particle. He is the most engaging, humorous, brilliant writer, Nobel Prize winner, full of humor. God's very much a part of what he writes. I read this poem to you the other day, and again in the context of insight removed. Such brilliance that just will not even consider God as a probability. And this message is fruitless unless some of you out there, getting off for so many years, with your cerebral brilliance in your view and keeping God on trial and absolutely refusing to start with the premise of God, he may be shoving you into the realm of darkness by withdrawing all insight. That's the wrath of God now, and as I said, I'm not as interested in those verses that follow that describe fleshly sins. That's the fruit of insight having been removed. That's the result of God's wrath. It isn't that you do those things and God then pours his wrath on you. You do those things because you're already the subject of wrath. Why God particle? He gave it the name. Two reasons. One, the publisher wouldn't let us call it the goddamn particle. Two, there is a connection of sorts to another book, a much older one. And he titles The Tower and the Accelerator. I want to finish this, so hang on with me, okay? The whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And you know the story. Let's go build brick and build a tower and reach God. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. He quotes it all. Which the children of men build, and the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they all have one language. And this they began to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they've imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel. Genesis 11:1-9. He's well acquainted with it. At one time, many millennia ago, long before those words were written, nature spoke but one language. He's brilliant. Everywhere matter was the same, beautiful in its elegant incandescent symmetry. But through the eons, it has been transformed, scattered throughout the universe in many forms, confounding those of us who live on this ordinary planet orbiting a mediocre star. There have been times in mankind's quest for a rational understanding of the world when progress was rapid, breakthroughs abounded, scientists were full of optimism. At other times, utter confusion reigns. In the past few decades, however, in particle physics, we have been in a period of such curious intellectual stress that the parable of the, couldn't possibly happen. The parable of the Tower of Babel seems appropriate. They become the preachers of this new age. Particle physicists have been using their giant accelerators to dissect the parts and processes of the universe. The quest has in recent years been aided by astronomers and astrophysicists who figuratively peer into giant telescopes to scan the heavens for residue sparks and ashes of a cataclysmic explosion that they are convinced took place 15 billion years ago, which they call the Big Bang. Both groups have been progressing toward a simple, coherent, all-encompassing model. Are we getting too close? Is there a nervous Grand Wizard of Oz? Are we getting too close to God and making him nervous? The issue is whether physicists will be confounded by this puzzle, because something that seems to pop out of all-pervading space, and it just seems to pop out, and that's in which all our planets, stars, and galaxies are embedded. Will we be confounded with this puzzle, or whether, in contrast to the unhappy Babylonians, we will continue to build the tower, and as Einstein put it, know the mind of God. And as Hawking said, when we understand it, we'll know the mind of God. And then he quotes from what I guess he's writing, the very New Testament, chapter 11:1. And the whole universe was of many languages and of many speeches. And it came to pass, now you've got to know, they're building this new collider that's going to discover Higgs boson and the God particle down in Texas, near a Pentecostal school in Waxahachie that I used to go in spiritual emphasis weeks to. Came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Waxahachie. And they dwelt there. And they said to one another, go to, let us build a giant collider, whose collisions may reach back to the beginning of time. And they had superconducting magnets for bending, and protons had they for smashing. And the Lord came down to see the accelerator, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people are unconfounding my confounding. And the Lord sighed and said, go to, let us go down, and there give them the God particle so that they may see how beautiful is the universe I have made. And as he comes to the end of this brilliant book, studying the whole flow of science down to the present moment, he has another very New Testament passage. If I can find it, again, I'll read it to you next Sunday, but I want to find it today. You going to wait with me?
Yes,
sir. Got it. The God particle at last. They found it. They found a shadow of it. They prolonged CERN, the biggest smasher at the time, and the race is on against Permalab up in the northeast and the midwestern northern tier. And they're building the one down in Waxahachie that's going to be 50-some miles long to get the speed necessary to smash these particles and get a glimpse of this Higgs boson, the particle of the Higgs field that's underneath it all. Now they've pushed it down to nothing. And he writes the very New Testament 3:1. And the Lord looked upon her world. Am I boring you? And she marveled at its beauty, for so much beauty there was that she wept. It was a world of one kind of particle and one force carried by one messenger who was with divine simplicity also the one particle. And the Lord looked upon the world she had created. She saw that it was also boring. So she computed and she smiled and she caused her universe to expand and to cool. And lo, it became cool enough to activate her tried and true agent, the Higgs field, which before the cooling could not bear the incredible heat of creation. And in the influence of Higgs, the particles suckled energy from the field and absorbed this energy and grew massive. Each grew in its own way, but not all the same. Some grew incredibly massive, some only a little, some not at all. And whereas before there was only one particle, now there were 12. And whereas before the messenger and the particle were the same, now they were different. And whereas before there was only one force carrier and one force, now there were 12 carriers and 4 forces. And whereas before there was an endless and meaningless beauty, now there were Democrats and Republicans. And the Lord looked upon the world she had created, and she was convulsed with holy, uncontrollable laughter. And she summoned Higgs, and suppressing her mirth, she dealt with him sternly and said, wherefore hast thou destroyed the symmetry of the world? And Higgs, shattered by the faintest suggestion of disapproval, defended thusly, O boss, I have not destroyed the symmetry. I have merely caused it to be hidden by the artifice of energy consumption. And in so doing, I have indeed made it a complicated world. This is brilliant. But wrong. Who could have foreseen that out of this dreary set of identical objects we could have nuclei and atoms and molecules and planets and stars? Who could have predicted the sunsets and the oceans and the organic ooze formed by all these awful molecules agitated by lightning and heat? And who could have expected evolution and those physicists poking and probing and seeking to find out what I have in your service so carefully hidden? And the Lord, hard put to stop her laughter, signed forgiveness and a nice raise for Higgs. One more. He ends his book by saying, there is either a purposeless world without meaning, or And brief and powerless is man's life on him and all his race, the slow, sure doom falls pitilessly in dark. To which I say softly, wow, this guy has a point. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems pointless. And there are the others who yearn to know the mind of God, that there's some point you can understand it all. But he says, I prefer the combination of the two approaches. He obviously had plenty of opportunity to see the Creator's hand. I prefer the combination. If we're going to work, patronizing, if we are going to work God in here somewhere, you got it? Let's call on the folks who have given us so many memorable images of her. Here is the script from the last scene in Hollywood's loving transmutation of this book. Insight gone. Brilliant beyond measure. This is the way he would like Hollywood to end it. The hero is the president of the Astrophysics Society, the only person ever to win 3 Nobel Prizes. He stands at night on the beach, legs planted wide, shaking his fist at the jewel blackness of the sky. Anointed by his humanity, aware of mankind's most powerful achievements, he shouts at the universe above the sound of crashing waves, I have created you. You are the product of my mind, my vision, my invention. It is I who provide you with reason, with purpose, with beauty. Of what use are you but for my consciousness and my constructions which have revealed you? A fuzzy, swirling light appears in the sky, and a beam of radiance illuminates our man on the beach. To the solemn and climactic chords of Bach B minor Mass, or perhaps the piccolo solo of Stravinsky's Rites, the light in the sky slowly configures itself into her face, smiling, but with an expression of infinite sweet sadness. Fade to black, roll credits. I told you I would show you, I'll do it next Sunday, the minor variations that make it impossible for this universe, as it is, on which we live, to exist without the 600 trillion miles of galaxies, space, matter in the macro section, and at the micro section, down to nothingness, from which God's Word says, He spoke His Word and made everything. Faith starts there. Faith believes that heaven and earth, this universe may pass away, but the one who made it with His Word will still be around to recreate again. A universe, the vastness of which had this kind of statistical probability, if chance governed it, of even a star developing, without which there would be no life, no atoms, no building blocks of nature. And the balance of this universe is such, you tilt it in any area, which I will show you next Sunday, in an article that has over 30 different elements, measured out the slightest increase or decrease. We are not. The whole universe, a balanced, magnificent creation for this one place where God said He would start over and create in His image, the purpose of which is to fill that gap left by the first rebel, the created musician of heaven, who became Satan and was cast out. Every person is given an insight. There's nothing wrong with searching through the universe and using this universe to enhance your appreciation of God. God's not against you understanding it. But what the world doesn't understand is living in this tunnel. The scientists have gone mad and become theorists and theologians, not theologians, religious philosophers, and have substituted themselves for the witches and medieval monks who suppressed an open mind. God's not afraid of learning. I want the kids in this church to be exposed as I take them to museums, but I don't want them to be gullible. Science is one avenue to truth. And this scientist who gave us the story of Stephen Hawking, whatever I did with it, says that he had given his life to science and the pursuit of science because he feels humbled by the fact that God at least allows him to explore one part of God's wonderful creation and the expression of his being. I will show you next Sunday why the slightest variation in this vast network would make us not be. When you look out at the starry heavens tonight, as far as the natural eye can see, which is a drop in the bucket to where the telescopes are taking us, without all of that, we would not be created in a balance to make this garden possible, where God could develop and send his Son to bring forth a new family to fill the gap in heaven. No wonder God is PO'd. No wonder he's angry that we rule him out of that which he created and made obvious his fingerprints. And he's not some fading she and sadly off having been eliminated from the creation. He made it for us, and he made us for himself to find our fulfillment in relationship to him. What a wonder that should produce worship and thanksgiving. The absence of it is to produce a senseless, moronic brain that can only come up with void and foolishness as you pursue the alternatives. And that's my message for today. Offering time. I just read by this distinguished Nobel Prize winner, brilliant writer, is to mock God and to make God a convenient joke for humorously showing off his own genius. If you were God and you really existed and you created all this, you'd be madder than hell at that kind of attitude, and you would turn them loose to their own vain imaginations and their own BS that Paul respectfully calls dialogues. Some of the acronyms of some of the scientists' viewpoints were FAP and RAP and PAP, and someone said, really, you ought to combine them properly. Just call it what it is, crap. The song says, our view, I'm so glad Jesus lifted me. Folks, will you go out and make your phone call reservations today?
Sir.
Don't let yourself, God, down. Don't let me down, your pastor. Don't let God down. You're here as a testimony. Offering time for me. Good day. The song is I'm So Glad Jesus Lifted Me.